So over the last couple of days, we've been exploring together some aspects of insight of spiritual death, but within the context of the whole mandala practice. So we've been exploring together. There are a lot of different ways in which you can think of a spiritual community. A sangha like ours has a lot of different aspects to it. But one of them is that you can see a sangha as a community of inquirers, a community of seekers after truth. All kind of sharing what we've seen, what we've understood, sharing our confusions, what we don't understand, and in that way helping one another to move to a greater seeing and a greater freedom. So over the last couple of days, we've been focusing on the six element practice. And the six element practice, I was talking at the beginning about how the goal of the practice is no different from the goal of sadhana practice, or just sitting, or metta practice, if you take metta into insight territory. And in that little meditation, we just had a sneaky go at taking metta into insight territory. Because when you get to the fifth stage, and the metta is going out in all directions to all beings, on a good day, when it goes well, there's really just another step that we need to take to turn what is a shamatha practice into an insight practice. To take it into what Bhante calls objectless metta. And he talks about that as the goal of the metta practice, but I don't know that we've made much of that up until recently. So when there's a very strong sense of metta going out to all beings, that sense of subject and object is quite attenuated, quite fine. So from there, we just need to see whether we can let that sort of subtle underlying sense of subject and object dissolve, whether it can be dropped. So one way to do that is to go from sending metta to all beings as the objects, the recipients of the metta, to let that sense of any kind of object of the metta go. So then there's just metta radiating, pervading everywhere. So there's no particular sense of any kind of object of the metta. There's just metta going out in all directions, so to speak. And then second step, it's like we've done something to let go of the object, so now we let go of the subject as best we can. So that sense that we have of me as the source of the metta, me the one who's doing the practice, me the one who's sending out metta, we see if we can let go of that. So now there's just a field of metta with no particular centre to it, no particular source, just all pervading. It's metta is everywhere. And then thirdly, we can just check whether there's still some kind of conceptual overlay on this, even the idea that there is metta is everywhere. Can we even let go of that and just, as it were, be the experience? Let go of the commentary, let go of the label, just completely, there is just what you can't say now. There is just what, when we put it back into words, we'll call great love. And that takes us into the same kind of territory, perhaps with more of a kind of loving kind of flavour to it, as when we let go and let go and let go in the six element practice. Yeah. We let go of the body, we let go of the sense of this territory, this me, my space. We let go of the emotions as me, the thoughts as me, whatever's going on, whatever mental movements there are. And we even let go of the sense of the awareness, the consciousness in which this is happening, so to speak. We even let go of that as being me. And yeah, without a point in space with which it's identified, again, there's that same just open, pervading experience. So all these different practices, they're all moving us in the same direction. And if you do two or several of them, they reinforce one another. So is that clear as the procedure? So with that metta, is it clear?
Sandra, can you just
new
points again, just briefly?
Yeah, sure. When I've talked about it, I've often talked in terms of unhooking, which is a term that Bhante used in as a way of dealing with actually with negative emotions, but it works here too. So there's the metta with the sense of me, sending metta to them. Yeah. So now we unhook from the object, we unhook from the them, we let go of a sense of beings out there that are receiving. And there's just metta going everywhere, pervading everyone, everything. But we're not focusing on the everyone and the everything. There's just metta going out. First stage. Second stage, we let go of me. Me, the one who feels like they're doing it. Me, the source. Me, the meditator. And each of these steps actually can sort of make these helps us to move more deeply into metta. Yeah. So, I mean, it all sounds very simple. It's not always this simple, obviously. I can say, "Oh, you just let go of, me, the meditator," but we do our best. We just feel our way into it. Yeah. With that. Following that sort of intuitive, there is a sort of inner compass in us, which does sort of kind of have a sense of where freedom lies. It's like you sometimes tap into it, and when you kind of, you can't tap into an inner compass, can you? You can sometimes contact it, and when you do, you can sort of follow. It's this sort of intuitively, but to get us in the ballpark. Okay, we do our best to let go of the object, we let go of the subject, and then thirdly, we let go of any kind of concept or idea about the feeling. Yeah. And just see what happens, see where we're left. Yeah.
And you're sort of sitting in that. Is there a good way to sort of come back out of that, or do you just, you know, like with some practices, you need to kind of dissolve it to sort of emerge back.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a kind of a bit of a health risk with this one?
I think if the practice fully unfolds, never mind the health risks, just go with it for a sec. But at some point you will come out of that and you will be back with a sense of me and what's just happened. I don't think there's any more of a health risk with it than with, you know, any strong meditation practice, really. Just give yourself time, be gentle with yourself, come out slowly, make sure you're really grounded, make sure you're really back in the body, come really back to feeling the earth. Yeah, nothing special. Okay. Actually, maybe while I'm getting one or two questions, I might answer one or two. I've had some dana in my bowl. All contributions gratefully received. So, yes, maybe we'll just run through one or two of these. Yes, let's do this one. Hello, Vasantra. Hello. I'm finding with the practices that convincing, in inverted commas, myself of no self leads to an attachment response, usually with anger as part of the content. So there's our questioner working with these practices, working to convince themselves of no self. But that just brings up a response of attachment, sort of closing down, closing in, usually with anger as part of it. I realise that this is driven by fear, my ego reacting to a threat. But the habit is strong and blame creeps in, either overtly or subtly. I've worked with it a lot, with metta, etc., but was wondering if you have any thoughts. Yeah. I end up feeling despondent at this samsaric response being so strong. Okay. So, I understand the process, but it's a shame if blame creeps in, because actually I want to say sadhu to this, because it's, most of us don't usually get anywhere near the point where we are looking sufficiently strongly to feel really challenged. It's actually quite a good sign when these sort of strong reactions come up. It shows that our usual kind of ways of operating, which keep us sort of trapped in our bubble, are starting to be, you know, that bubble is being sort of shaken up, yeah? And that then produces these strong responses. Yeah, it's a bit like our practice has gone deep enough that Mara's now, you know, had to take an interest, whereas before he didn't have to bother with us because we were too busy, you know, distracting ourselves and so on. Yeah. So yeah, we can expect quite often we'll get some kind of strong responses when we start trying to look into the nature of things. And sometimes, yeah, there can be anger. This is all stupid, this whole trying to see no self, it's just a lot of conceptual this, that and the other. Or it can be boredom. You can get very, very tired and disinterested. Although you have to make sure that as I said the other day, that doesn't just come in from having kind of pushed too hard. You really need to kind of give your mind space around all this. Yeah, it's better off that you kind of do quite a lot of relaxing and a lot of openness, and then from time to time you have a look at how things are. That will tend to work better than pushing. So I realise that this is driven by fear. And that's a really good seeing too, realising that that's the real issue. My ego, which of course isn't a real thing, it's reacting to a threat. But the habit is strong. Yeah. Well, there's a strong habit in all of us, avidyā, which is translated as ignorance, is really a kind of ongoing habit of ignoring how things are. It's an ongoing habit of not seeing what's there. It's like, I'm not going to look. You can't make me. I'm not going to. It's like that, really. And there's an awful lot of energy which goes into kind of avoiding seeing how things are. Because how things are is how things are, and so it's kind of staring us in the face all the time. But that fear is very natural because, the way in which we've been operating has been useful. It's served us. It's got us through life up to this point. And we are going into what feels like the unknown. We are very used to kind of controlling or doing our best to control things and to let go of that appearance of control feels a bit like kind of going off the edge of a cliff sometimes. So again, it's partly about gathering resources. We're being really sort of sympathetic with that fear, not just sort of trying to push it away. Yes, we don't let it stop us, we keep moving, but we really kind of need to look after those aspects of ourselves which are uneasy, worried, frightened, terrified sometimes. And for me, a major resource is just knowing some people who I'm confident have really kind of gone a long way down this track, because I kind of look at the next bit of my spiritual life and think, oh, I don't like the look of that. but then I look at Bhante, or I look at other people who I know who I'm confident have gone through this bit and gone out the other side, and they're freer than me, wiser than me, more relaxed than me, happier than me. Not necessarily all the time, but far more than I am. And I see how much they've given to the world and how much they give to people and how open their hearts are. And that makes me think, okay, right. So there's this kind of fear of losing everything, of sort of being destroyed, which often comes up. And that's a fear that we have to find our way gently through. Yeah. Because, as I've sometimes said, it's like the Buddha doesn't kind of get up from his tree thinking, oh, rats, I used to have a self and I don't have one, I've broken it. Oh, no! No, he just comes out and sort of has so much kind of love and wisdom that for the next 35 years, you know, he just teaches people and creates a wave of energy which goes through 2,500 years. So, yeah, what's waiting for us on the other side of spiritual death is a wonderful spiritual rebirth. Okay. But part of the fear is a fear of experience with no content. Yeah, just open awareness. It feels like, yeah, there's that fear that if there isn't something to be identified with, then there's just nothing. But there isn't just nothing. It's a bit like kind of sort of going into the vast blue sky. You know, if you're, that could feel kind of scary. But they could, oh gosh, oh, I was in Greece in the summer. And no, it wasn't, it was Finland. It was Helsinki, that's right.
I always make that mistake.
Yeah, it's so easy to do. That's right, I was in Helsinki walking along in by the water, and there was a great big crane, and it was for bungee jumping. You know, it was like really, I don't know, it was really, you know, 300 foot high or something, well over 100 meters. Yes, Suvanna Chandra knows. And yeah, I watched this young girl being kind of taken up on it and then jumping off, or yeah, she kind of let herself fall off this platform, and she was, you know, sort of started kind of bouncing on the end of the bungee. And to start with, it was, I felt like I was watching somebody being tortured. You know, it was like, and she was obviously kind of had this kind of terror response, and her body was being sort of thrown around, and it really hurt me. But then at a certain point, you could see that she relaxed, and then it's like she was just, you know, kind of free in this space. And this great sort of view, and you know, she sort of gradually sort of came down, and so we're a bit like that, yeah. Yeah, there's this great fear that, you know, if we kind of aren't holding on, you know, if we aren't identified, if we're not holding on to the body, if we're not holding on to the thoughts, if we're not holding on to the emotions, if we're not holding on to me, the consciousness, then we'll just be, you know, there'll just be this open space and we're lost. And there's that fear of losing ourselves. Apparently, somebody told me once that Gelugpa monks have a particular little bit of their robe which is sort of sticks out a little bit, and it's there to commemorate a teaching that Tsongkhapa gave. He was talking about emptiness, and at a certain point, one of the monks in the audience obviously started to have that feeling of just kind of losing all ground, because he sort of grabbed his robe sort of like that, and Tsongkhapa sort of saw it and kind of, you know, sort of started talking to him about it. So ever since, they have this little bit. I guess it's like a sort of safety blanket for insight practitioners, you know, something you can grab onto to feel, no, I'm still here. Whoa. But if we look at it, actually, all our best experiences were when we weren't here. Yeah, all the times where, you know, we got really deeply involved in the music, or we, you know, we're completely engaged in communication. Yeah. or really engaged in something creative, or just looking at a sunset or whatever, in those moments, we weren't really there. Afterwards, there was more of a sense of, oh, that was really beautiful, or sometimes I did that really well. But in the time that it's going on, in those real sort of peak moments, there isn't a sense of me. Or at least, there probably is, but it's a very subtle one. Whereas the times where I'm really kind of concerned about me and, oh gosh, and this has just happened and that's just happened and now I've done that and I made a complete mess of this and I've got a very strong sense of me and there's hardly any sense of anything else. Yeah. So we need to learn to, I'd much rather do it on a meditation cushion than up in the air, sort of on a bunch of... But we need to learn that it's actually okay when there's just open experience. Yeah. We need to be able to just relax, learn to relax into it. And it can take some time to do that. It's like often we start to have those kinds of experiences and then there's an instinctive kind of... almost sort of like bodily kind of sort of pulling back. Yeah. So we have to just keep learning to relax and relax and relax into that. And then there's just freedom and it's completely peaceful and just like the big blue sky. There's freedom, there's peace, there's nothing to worry about. It's all transcendentally hunky-dory. Sorry. I have a very associative mind. Right. Yeah, so we can expect resistances and things, and rather than feeling ashamed or bad, we can feel, well, no, actually, that's a sign that I'm on a track that's going somewhere. And we can build all the resources we can to work with the fear. And especially, we can keep working with a sense of appreciation, devotion, of the qualities of enlightenment, whether they're in Ayyadam or the Buddha, or in people that we know or we've read about. I think reading life stories of great practitioners is a really good thing to do, because it just keeps giving us a sense of, yes, all this is worth doing. It's worth going through the anger and the blaming and the fear. There's so much that can come out of all that if we just arrive at that greater freedom. One more quickly. Regarding nihilism and the six element practice, if this happens, is it appropriate to connect with the beauty of the elements and then let go? Find the sweet spot between beauty and impermanence. Yeah, it is. The six element practice has always left me dead. I think this is the wrong kind of death. This isn't what we're looking for, is it? Not finding it stimulating at all. Is it because I'm not a six element type? I remember practicing the five skandhas on solitary many moons ago. and found a mysterious play with my awareness and the sense of freedom that you've mentioned. I think, you know, if you really don't connect with the six element practice and you really connect with the five skandhas, then work with the five skandhas, because it's just another way of covering the same territory. But what might be interesting would be just to get a, I'm not sure about whether there is such a thing as a six element type or not, but it would be interesting just to be a bit curious about the difference between meditating with the skandhas, which seems to really work for you, and meditating with the elements, which leaves you dead. I'd be curious about, yeah, how are they? What's the difference? Which means that one feels really effective, and the other just leaves you cold. But yes, the main thing is that we get deeply into exploring the lakshanas. So, yeah, if one way really, you know, feels as if it's closed for us, then let's pick a way which feels like it's inviting. Okay, we'll do one more, then we'll have a little break, and we'll do some more practice in the second half. Oh yes, this one's a bit theoretical, but it'd be good to make sure we're clear. Dear Vasantara, if it's our identification, our holding on, that is the cause of our suffering, and, well, we need to check for ourselves, but it's my experience. If having an identity like that is suffering, do we need an identity at all? Is having an identity necessary to our in our early life? When I was a teenager, I struggled to find an identity that was different to my family. I wanted to have a me that I felt good about. Again, when I encountered Buddhism and Tru Ratna, I was happy to have found something that made sense of who I was and how life was. I think I turned Buddhism into my identity. Is it possible or desirable to avoid the identity issue from the start? Or do we need to build a positive identity in life before we relax out of it? Bhante, in his lectures about the higher evolution, talks about how we go from a kind of simple consciousness where there's not much self-awareness, and therefore, you know, we feel like we're just part of life, but we're also just kind of in a way the victim of life, in as much as we just take in whatever we take in. We're born and there we are, and in a particular family and a particular environment, and we're given the views and the emotions that are in that situation, and these things come in really early, sort of under our radar, before we've developed the self-awareness to know what we're taking in. And then we move from that to a self-awareness where we know that we know, and In the early days, when I was first around Tru Ratna, Bhante was making a lot of the importance of that stage, of kind of emancipating ourselves from group values. So there's definitely a part of our process of evolution, of unfolding as human beings, is that we kind of forge ourselves like a sword, you know, that we've taken in all these kind of views and emotion, ways of responding emotionally, and stories about life, and we have to kind of check those out and go, you know, do I really believe those? You know, Are those really the basis on which I want to live my life? Are those the values that I want to live my life from? And so on. Yeah. So in that way, we sort of forge an individuality and a kind of identity, which is separate from what's just available in the atmosphere. And we need to keep on doing that because the media and so on are constantly, they're not just giving us news and so on, they're actually giving us views of life that are sort of behind that news. Yeah. We need to really keep alert to being sort of subtly seduced into ways of looking at life and ideas about what will really make us happy, or into sort of having responses to situations which are based on horrified anxiety and so on, which are all being offered us all the time through the media and advertising. Yeah. So we need to keep doing this. But then, in the higher evolution discussions, Bhante says, well, yes, but that having kind of become a self-aware individual isn't the end of the story. There's then a further flowering of awareness. There's a further transformation of awareness into what we could call transcendental awareness, which goes beyond any kind of identification of ourselves being attached to, clinging on to any kind of ego reference. Yeah. And at that point, there's something that's kind of where the Dharma Niyama, the bodhicitta, or whatever we want to call it, where all that aspect of things starts to fully come into play. So I don't think we could just start and go straight into that having no identity, I don't think that's possible. I think that actually we need to keep doing both processes. Yeah? So I say we still need to be doing that process of kind of forging ourselves and really kind of discriminating and becoming more and more individual in the sense of aware of the processes that are going on. And along with that, we can also be seeing through fixed self and opening our hearts, opening our minds. And those two processes actually support one another. Spiritual life, lots of the maps of spiritual life go first you do this, and then you do that, and then you do that, and then you do that. And in the path of regular steps, you can't totally complete a higher stage until you've completed a lower stage. But certainly my experience is that we're not a sort of unified being. I'm not a unified being at a unified stage of the path. I'm a sort of spread. The image I usually use is it's like kind of watching a. I did the Bristol Half Marathon years ago, so right up the front you've got the Kenyan runners, who are doing under 5 minute miles. I'm really kind of going for it, and then you've got the good club runners. And then you've kind of got people like me, and then you've got people further back who are kind of all running for charity in kind of rhino suits or as giraffes or Superman or Superwoman or whatever. And then you've got the people down the back with blisters who are kind of walking. But the aim of the stewards, is to get everyone across the finishing line in one piece. And spiritual life is like that, I think. It just is. On my 3-year retreat, I would have days where, in the course of a day, I would be having occasionally quite profound, sort of seeings into things. And at other times, dealing with my 4-year-old self that was, very much wanting attention and all sorts of different things going on. Yeah. But you just work with it all. Yeah. But the yes, so we work with our ethics and our meditation and our wisdom. We keep working on becoming more individual at the same time as going completely beyond ourselves. And wherever, whatever needs addressing on whatever level at the moment, we address that. Yeah? Because that idea that we're here on the path and we shouldn't be like that and all those ideas very often get in the way. We just need to address the reality of who we are at the moment. So if I'm a 4-year-old right now as I'm talking to you, then I need to address that. Okay, let's have a 22-minute break till 12:10.